I am your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, a true crime podcast designed like an anthology horror movie. It's definitely not for the faint of heart and never played for laughs. Listener discretion is strongly advised. In seasons 1 and 2, we highlighted both notorious and obscure incidents of real-life murder, from world-famous psychopaths like the Toolbox Killers and the Night Stalker Richard Ramirez, to lesser-known evils that you may not have heard of, but have effects just as catastrophic for the victims and their families. Season 3 is coming soon, so subscribe now wherever podcasts can be consumed, and check out our website at www.truecrimehorrorstory.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.
I'm your host, Paige, and you're listening to Reverie True Crime. Every episode is definitely not the easiest to listen to, but this episode, I must warn you, is about a 2-year-old baby boy who was murdered by 2 10-year-old boys. If you cannot handle subjects like this, I urge you not to listen. 2 of many sources for this episode are Denise Fergus's book, I Let Him Go, and Ralph Bulger's book, My James. If you go to 4james.org, it's a wonderful website that you can purchase Denise's book and learn about the James Bulger Memorial Trust. You can also go to the Facebook page, James Bulger Memorial Trust, and give a like and read through it. All of this will be in the show notes. Denise is doing so much for children. I feel it's important to tell you really quick what the James Bulger Memorial Trust is about. Sourcing from 4james.org, the aims and objectives of the James Bulger Memorial Trust are to benefit and support young people who are disadvantaged by reason of having become the victims of crime, hatred, or bullying. To reward those who are judged to have shown exemplary conduct, making a positive contribution to the welfare of others or society in general. To do so by providing cost-free travel and holiday accommodation for such children and their families, along with a range of other tangible rewards as deemed appropriate by the trustees or their appointed representatives, and to support other organizations benefiting children in similar circumstances as deemed appropriate by the trustees. So please donate if you can and read more on the website. This case has been requested quite a few times, and I know it's such a hard pill to swallow, but these stories must be told. I do openly invite Denise, Ralph, and Stuart onto the show. If I get anything wrong or you have something you'd like to say, I'd love for you to sit down with me and tell me everything that you'd like. With that being said, if you think you can stomach this tragic story, let's begin. In June of 1988, Denise and Ralph Bulger experienced their first tragic event together when their little baby girl was stillborn. Later on the same day, Ralph popped the big question to Denise, "Will you marry me?" On the 16th of September 1989, Denise's 22nd birthday, the two said their I do's at the Knowsley Register Office. After they got married, they went home and had a sweet family gathering to rejoice in their wonderful day. At this time, Denise was pregnant. The two were a bit nervous and scared that there was a possibility of Denise losing another baby. Fortunately, little James Patrick Bulger was welcomed into the world on March 16, 1990, in Kirkby, Merseyside, England. He was a beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed bundle of joy. He was the most joyful baby and sharp as a tack. Ralph said in his book, My James, that even when he was only a few months old, James tried his best to talk to them. When James was a little older, he started to call his dad Ralph instead of Daddy. Everyone else called him Ralph, and he loved to repeat it. While in his red car, James would say, Ralph, Ralph, come and push me. And Ralph would reply, No, James, I'm your dad. You have to call me Daddy. James would respond with, Okay, Ralph, now come and push me. Ralph stated that he could still hear the calls of James' little voice saying his name as he played in his modest-sized red car. It was obvious that James was so special to his parents, and they were great parents. They loved him so much, and he was their entire world. One of James's favorite things to do was dance to Michael Jackson's music, and he got so tickled when he made others laugh. Denise recalled one of her favorite memories of her baby boy was when he would run to her and his hair would bob up and down. Denise remembers that James rarely walked. He was a tiny little runner. He loved to race into people's arms with a big smile on his face. Here's a clip from an interview with Bay TV Liverpool as she shares details about her son.
Tell us something first about James. What kind of little boy was he?
Very pleasant. Loves entertaining people. He never walked anywhere. Always bounced everywhere. He had kind of long blonde hair that moved every time he bounced. His personality was just great to be around. And when you were in his company, he just made you laugh.
And tell us, what are the memories of him that you cherish most?
I've still got a lot of memories of James that I do cherish, as the way he used to bounce around, and I used to read a book to him, make sure he'd read it back, so he was learning from an early age. He knew his ABCs, he could count. He was just an amazing little boy, and I spent a lot of time teaching him stuff.
And he was keen on the Turtles and Michael Jackson, I think.
Oh, he absolutely loved Michael Jackson. Was more often him putting his music on than me. A lot of people said I brainwashed him into liking Michael Jackson. Obviously, I'm a big Michael Jackson fan myself, and I wouldn't have to put Michael Jackson's video on. James would do that for me, and every time he put the video on, he'd dance to him, he tried to move like Michael, and it was just so funny. It was hilarious to watch.
And mementos that you've got of James, what are those things that you cherish of him?
To this day, I've still got James's jumper folded to the bottom of a drawer. I've kept everything of his, all his toys. I've kept all his clothes. It's just something that I can't part with. James will always be a part of my life. I don't keep looking at them or anything like that. I just know that they're there. But this certain jumper that I have got, I can still kind of smell James on it.
The purity, innocence, and the trust that toddlers have for others is such a beautiful thing. Unfortunately, that innocence, that trust, and loving behavior can be taken advantage of by people that have terrible intentions. These people don't have to be adults. As scary as it is, they can also be children. On the 12th of February, 1993, Denise and her little James were at the Strand Shopping Center in Bootle, Merseyside. As most of us know, doing any task and trying to keep a toddler in place is extremely difficult. They like to run around and not stay in one place for too long. James, being a curious and free-spirited little tot, wandered off while his mom was at a butcher shop. Denise looked down, and he was gone. She frantically ran out of the butcher shop, which was captured by security cameras, as she searched for James. She got in touch with security. They announced James Bulger's name over the loudspeakers of the shopping center, and the police were called immediately. About a minute after she was seen on the security footage, James was also filmed on the upper level of the shopping center, walking closely with two kids. Eventually, two boys spotted little James outside of the door of the butcher shop. They took his hand and they all walked away. This all happened so fast, roughly within 1 minute and 39 seconds. These two boys had skipped school that day, which they did often, and they were also seen stealing and throwing things around the mall. Also, before they took James, they attempted to abduct two other children. A mom of a 3-year-old girl and 2-year-old boy noticed her children had disappeared. The distressed mother did find her daughter and asked her where her little brother was, and she said, "Gone outside with the boy." The mother found them outside, and the boys acted innocent, telling the child to go back to his mom. Also that day, they stole candy, batteries, blue paint, and other items caught by CCTV. There were people who saw James and the two boys, and they asked them where they were going. The two boys told people lies about James being their little brother and another lie saying they found the little boy and were taking him to the police station. And none of the adults stepped in or questioned it. People even witnessed the poor baby being hit, shaken, and kicked by the two boys. Some even saw James crying. But these onlookers didn't do anything about it. Ralph says in his book, My James, quote, "There would be times when, quite unfairly, I blamed Denise. I was wrong, very, very wrong. It was just part of my raging grief. I wanted to scream, 'Why did you let go of his hand? Why did you let him out of your sight? He would still be here if it wasn't for you.' I am deeply ashamed of blaming Denise. She loved James with her heart and soul, and what happened that day was not her fault. It could have been any parent's child." End quote. This is where the story gets even worse. It's very important to me that people know what these two did to James. A child is one of the most innocent beings on this earth, and what happened to him needs to be told because of the injustice that has gone on for way too long, which I will get into more later. If you don't think you can handle these details, I do urge you to hit that 30-second skip button a few times. Reportedly, the boys led James to a railroad track that was a little over 2 miles away from the shopping center. Once they were there, they splashed the blue paint that they had stole into the baby's eyes. They threw rocks at him, kicked him repeatedly, and smashed James in the face with 27 bricks. The two went on to hit him on the head with a 22-pound iron bar. They stuffed the batteries that they had stolen into the toddler's mouth and anus, and they sexually assaulted him. The last act was putting James's deceased body on the railroad tracks, trying to make it all look like an accident as a train was coming, which split the baby in two. They left his remains near the tracks, and James was found 2 days later. According to Ralph Bulger's book, My James, he says, quote, "A group of teenage boys was playing alongside a railway track in Walton on that cold Sunday afternoon when they spotted what they first thought was a doll or a dead cat on the track between Edgehill and Bootle," end quote. James didn't have on shoes, socks, pants, or underpants, and was a little bit further away from his top half, which he still had his little jacket on. It's suspected that the bricks were holding James's head down, which caused the train to carry the lower half off a little further. The pathologist's report, which was read out loud in court, found that Bulger's foreskin had been pulled back with force. There were 42 injuries in all, and it's not certain which act was the actual cause of death. Okay, let's take a moment to breathe during this commercial break.
Lock your doors, check under the bed, and turn on a nightlight, because it's time for the scariest stories, history, and conversations ever heard. If you struggle to find a great, scary podcast, listen to Scary Time by Indie Drop-In and explore a new creator every week. They'll be telling you about paranormal, ghosts, monsters, hauntings, creepy places, enchanted objects, aliens, and more. Best of all, if you like the creator, you can follow them for more great content. If you dare. That's Scary Time by Indie Drop-In, wherever you stream your podcasts.
Ralph's brother Jimmy recalls in Ralph's book, My James, Ralph was gaunt, sunken in the face, and totally done in. At one stage, I volunteered to go back to the police station to see if there was any news. As soon as I got there, I knew it was bad. The look in the officer's eyes gave it away. Then he told me they had found a body. I remember an awful pain in the pit of my stomach. My legs seemed as if they were going to give way. It was the most awful thing to have to tell your baby brother. His life was about to change forever. When I turned, I took a deep breath and walked over to the passenger seat of the car, where Ralph was sitting. "I've got some news, Ralph," I said. "It's not good, I'm afraid." Ralph leapt from the car, and we walked a few yards before I just threw my arms around him and held him for dear life. My heart was beating so fast as I clung to him, not wanting to say the words. "Ralph, they have found baby James. They have found him. I am so, so sorry, but he is dead. He's dead, Ralph." Ralph goes on to say, "I walked into a toilet cubicle and felt a rush of nausea. My stomach was in agonizing spasms, and my limbs turned to jelly. I began retching, but nothing came up. When I looked at my reflection in the mirror, I saw a stranger. My eyes looked like they were going to pop out of my head, blazing with anger and bloodshot from tears and rage. But most of all, I could see the shame and disgust. I hated myself because my son was dead. I had failed to protect my own flesh and blood. When we got back to Marsh Lane Police Station, I just let rip. 'Where's my son?' I screamed. 'I want to see my James now. What the fuck have they done to him? I'm going to kill the bastards.' 'I'm sorry, Ralph, but you can't see him now,' replied the officer with great compassion. 'Are you sure it's him? How do you know it's my baby?' 'We're very sure, Ralph, and I'm so very sorry.' The next thing I remember, I was punching the walls, and I was just kicking and screaming before I collapsed and wailed like a baby. Denise was waiting for me in the police television room, rocking gently and crying. I just held her and kissed her on the head. We were both crying together, trapped in a world of pain that no one else could ever understand. Denise was inconsolable. To hear your wife crying in such a way is unbearable. It was like listening to a wounded animal. There is no question that I considered killing myself. The only thing that stopped me from doing so was the thought that I would be letting James down once again. Of course, as any investigation goes, the parents were the first to be interrogated, and initially they were suspects, but the cops were looking over the CCTV film and saw exactly what happened. They thought the two boys looked to be around 12 to possibly 18 years old. Phil Roberts, a man that was on Merseyside's Serious Crime Team during this time said, quote, "It showed James hand in hand and what we thought was a teenager. There was another boy in front. We thought he was about 13. That was a surprise that two youths had apparently taken him. We immediately started combing records of anyone between the ages of 12 and 18 who might be involved. We brought in several boys, but as soon as I started questioning them, I knew they weren't involved." End quote. The police went to all nearby schools to check to see who was absent on the 12th. Believe it or not, some parents reported their own children as the potential killers since they weren't at school that day. When the toddler's body was found by those four teenage boys, they noticed his body was doused in blue paint. With police looking over the CCTV footage, they saw two boys had stolen blue paint from a store at the shopping center that day. Then, an anonymous woman went to Marsh Lane Police Station. According to the book My James, the woman said she was a friend of one of the boys' families, and she knew the son had skipped school with a friend on the Friday that James went missing. He had returned home with blue paint on his jacket. Another bit of evidence that put these two at the scene of the crime was the blood discovered on the right shoe of one of the killers. When the two were interrogated, they started pointing fingers at each other, but eventually, one of the boys spilled the beans. He said, quote, "I did kill him. What about his mom? Will you tell her I'm sorry?" End quote. The other boy denied everything. One gave himself away by telling what James Bulger was wearing the day he went missing. This child seemed completely calm and collected through the whole interrogation, never shedding a tear. He was publicly known as the boy who did not cry. What I'm about to play is some of the interrogation audio. These boys were questioned over a period of 3 days, so some questions do repeat, but each clip does have different things in them. So I'll play that for you now.
He said that the two of you were in the Strand and that you saw the little boy.
We never.
Is that the God's honest truth?
God's honest truth, I'm telling you that we never. He was too scared. He was probably too scared.
And he said that you took him by the hand and led him out of the Strand shops.
We never. He's a liar.
Calm down.
Oh my gosh.
All right, come on. I never killed someone. Yeah, we was, but we never saw any kids there. We never robbed any kids.
So you were in Bootle, New Strand?
Yeah, was you in Bootle Strand?
We never got a kid, Mum. We never got
Mrs.
a kid.
Mrs. Venables, I must ask you not to get angry with her. A short while ago, as is detailed on your custody record out there, you had a conversation with your mum and you then requested that myself and Dave Tanner come into the room. Is that right? Yeah. And what was it you told us?
That I killed James. He took him around so I started throwing bricks at him.
Why did he throw bricks at him?
No.
Did it make him fall over?
No.
So you're saying he threw the same house brick at him, full in the face, and he didn't fall over?
Yeah, he did fall over. And he just kept on getting back up again. He wouldn't stay down.
What was he saying while he was doing all this?
He was saying, stay down, you stupid dick, and all that.
Why did he want him to stay down?
I don't know. Wanted them dead, probably. So we walked up to him and we were walking around with him and I took his hand.
And whose idea was it to walk towards him?
Mine.
Was it?
Then it was Robert's idea to kill him. And we went outside to the canal.
What for?
Don't know. He said, let's throw him in the water. He was persuading him. He said, kneel down, let's look at the water and all that, but he wouldn't. Because when we wouldn't get him down, Robert kicked him up and threw him on the floor, and that's where he got his bump on his head.
Who took hold of him?
Robert. He was dragging him along the road where the security camera was.
Where'd you go with him after that?
The reservoir where that woman spotted us.
Is young James walking with you by this time, or are you still having to pull him?
He was walking with us.
Was he upset, or had he made friends with you?
He was all nice.
No, you know these video films, don't you? I went too fast here, right? You know these videos, these video cameras?
They're plugged down to the ceiling.
Correct. And they look down on everything that goes on in the Strand, don't they? You shaking your head, see?
Yeah.
I know the truth. I believe
so
I know the truth.
I was there.
Yeah, that's right.
You waved.
Correct, but I know that a lot of things that have gone on.
Yeah, well, do you know it was me that killed them? It wasn't. I never even killed him.
What time was that? When was that?
I don't know.
So what did John...
What happened?
Don't know. He grabbed the baby's hand and just walked around the Strand. And then he let him go loose then.
Did he?
When we were by the church, he let him go.
And you were with John then? You shook your head. You shook your head.
Yeah. I told him to take him back.
You did what?
I told him to take him back.
You told him to take him back?
Don't know. All right, Bobby.
No, so you're not getting all the blame. We're just asking your son. We're trying to find the truth.
We always get the blame.
Wait a minute, Bobby. Listen. Just calm yourself down for a minute, okay? You alright?
Yeah. He said he wants us more.
So what? What did you say to him?
What did you say?
You.
We're going to try and find us, Mum.
Where did you leave him then?
On the reservoir place.
I don't believe you would have left him there. You took him away from where the reservoir is and walked down somewhere else.
Where?
Going towards the police station.
I never killed him. You're saying that I've got blood and you
That's
think
right.
It's off babe James?
Correct.
Don't you think it's not the truth?
Grab hold of James.
I don't know.
You don't know?
He might have made them follow on behind us.
Did he?
And then got him lost somewhere.
Well, were you with him then?
When?
With John when that happened?
No.
Why won't you tell us?
What?
Why won't you tell us?
I never even killed him.
Bobby.
What?
Try and stop. Right, we're getting there, aren't we? We're getting to the truth now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to end up getting all the blame because I've got blood on me.
Under caution, and you do not have to say anything unless you wish to do so, but anything you say may be given in evidence. Now, you understand that, don't you, John?
Yeah.
All right. I have a photograph here, which is a video camera photograph.
That's me.
So the boy holding James's hand is you.
Yeah.
And the boy ahead of you in the dark jacket and trousers, Robert Thompson.
Yeah.
And what was it you told us?
I killed James.
Right. Now, I know that took a lot of doing.
I can't tell you anything else.
Why?
That's the worst bit.
Why? Okay, right. I know that's the worst bit, but you know what you did. Why? Think about it. Why? And just tell us what happened.
We took him on the rail and shot and started throwing bricks at him. And then...
Who did?
Robbie.
Why did he throw bricks at him?
No.
Where did the stick, where did the stones and the bar hit him?
In the head.
Was he bleeding?
Oh, neither.
Where was he bleeding from?
The face. Then it was Robert's idea to kill him.
Okay.
Is it finished now because I can't speak anymore?
He hit him where exactly?
In the face.
In the face.
I think he hit him in the eyes.
And he hit him in the eyes. Right.
Now, was James making any noises then?
He was knocked out.
He was knocked out. Was he moving at all?
No, you know these video films, don't you? I went too fast here, right? You know these videos, these video cameras?
They plug down to the ceiling.
Correct. And they look down at everything that goes on in the Strand, don't they? You shaking your head, see?
Yeah.
I know the truth. I believe
I
know the truth.
I was there.
That's right.
You waved.
Correct, but I know that a lot of things have gone on.
Yeah, well, do you know it was me that killed him? It wasn't. I never even killed him. Why would I take flowers over to the baby?
I don't know. It's up to you.
If I killed him.
Well, you were there. Why did you take flowers? You knew who did it, didn't you?
Yeah.
Who?
John. I didn't throw any bricks because Robert said pick a brick off and throw it. I just threw it on the floor.
What happened then?
And then he hit on the bench.
What
it was like a big metal thing that had holes in.
A big metal thing with holes in? Where did he hit him with that?
In the head.
Now which part of the head?
Up there.
On the top of the head.
What was Robert saying while he was doing all this?
He was saying stay down, you stupid dick and all that.
Why did he want him to stay down?
I don't know. I wanted him dead, probably.
Where did the stones and the bar hit him?
In the head.
And you say the bar knocked him out?
Yeah. Onto the railway track.
And what happened then?
No, he was just lying there. Is it finished now because I can't speak anymore?
Grab hold of James.
I don't know.
You don't know?
He might have made them follow on behind us.
Did he?
And then got him lost somewhere.
Well, were you with him then?
When?
With John when that happened?
No.
Where did you find James?
Outside the butcher's. So we walked up to him and we were walking around with him and I took his hand.
Well, whose idea was it to walk towards him?
Mine.
Was it?
Then it was Robert's idea to kill him. And we went outside to the canal.
What for?
Don't know, we said let's throw him in the water. He was persuading him, he said kneel down and let's look at the water and all that, but he wouldn't. Because when we wouldn't get him down, Robert picked him up and threw him on the floor and that's where he got his bump on his head.
Who took hold of him?
Robert. He was dragging him along the road where the security camera was.
Where'd you go with him after that?
The reservoir where that woman spotted us.
Is young James walking with you by this time, or are you still having to pull him?
He was walking with us.
Was he upset, or had he made friends with you?
He was all nice.
He said he wants us more.
So what? What did you say to him?
What did you say?
You.
We're going to try and find us, Mum.
Where did you leave him then?
On the reservoir place.
I don't believe you would have left him there. You took him away from where the reservoir is and walked down somewhere else.
Where?
Going towards the police station.
I never killed him.
Why had you carried on walking away with him up to the reservoir?
Take him up to Walton Village.
What were you gonna? Why were you taking him up to Walton Village?
Don't know. We didn't know what to do.
You walk along. Where?
To the train track.
The boys had walked James nearly 3 miles.
Yeah, we was, but we never saw any kids there. We never robbed any kids.
So you were in Bootle New Strand?
Yeah, was you in Bootle Strand?
Yeah, but we never got a kid, Mum. We never got
Mrs.
a
Venables,
kid.
Mrs. Venables, would you... I must ask you not to get angry with him.
You're saying that I've got blood and you
That's
think
right.
it's off babe James?
Correct.
Don't you think it's not the truth?
A short while ago, as is detailed on your custody record out there, you had a conversation with your mum. And you then requested that myself and Dave Tanner come into the room. Is that right? Yeah. And what was it you told us?
That I killed James.
Right. Now,
there's no point in telling lies.
I never got a kid, Mum.
Quiet yourself down.
Because if I would have said it, but you would have thought I killed him.
During the arrest and trial, the names of these killer kids were not made public because they were only 10 years of age. Due to the absolute outrage, and rightly so, of the public, the two were taken to adult court to be tried, and they were found guilty of murder. This is when Judge Justice Moreland named the killers. They were Robert Thompson and John Venables. Blake Morrison wrote a book called As If, A Crime, A Trial, A Question of Childhood. In the book, he says, quote, Venables had a temper and had been known to lose control and had done some pretty weird things, and it was just as likely that he was the instigator, end quote. It's never been proven, but a lot of people do believe that John Venables was the leader of the two, which also comes with what John Venables would go on to do years later, and how Robert Thompson took a different path in life. John and Robert were sent to a safe place for kids, and they were to serve a sentence of only 8 years. To this day, not a single professional has ever been able to figure out what the motive was. But the psychiatrists that the court appointed did conclude that these two 10-year-olds knew the difference from right and wrong and were not sociopaths. Robert and John were the youngest kids in 250 years to be convicted of such a horrible crime in Britain. In 1995, Denise and Ralph Bulger's marriage ended after the birth of their second son. Denise married a great man named Stuart Fergus. They went on to have 2 sons together. Ralph also remarried and went on to have 3 daughters with his new wife. In 2001, John and Robert were now 18. They were evaluated, released, and given new secret identities. James's parents have stated that the nonsensical killing of their baby has brought on pure devastation to their family. They were having a difficult time trying to keep going after their loss, plus the massive interest that the public had about their family. It was all too much. In 2015, Denise was asked in an interview with Bay TV Liverpool who she thinks is to blame. Here's what she had to say.
They'd tortured animals and clearly had been planning this. Who do you blame for what happened? Obviously them, but what about their parents?
Well, definitely blame them too. But, you know, the parents should have been monitoring them anyway. I know where my kids are all the time. Them two should have been at school. And thankfully now when kids don't attend school, the school actually phone the parents to ask where they are. And I think that's a really good idea because then you know if they're meant to be in school and they're not, then you want to know where they are. As I say, I know where my kids are all the time. My kids have got mobile phones and they have done since they've gone to school, and the teachers understand why. They're only allowed to use them for serious users. Now, if I want to get in touch with them, which I try not to when they're in school hours.
We know that they'd tortured animals and and that they'd, as you said, tried to abduct another child earlier. Do you think that anything would have stopped them doing what they were going to do on that day? Or, as you say, they'd set out to do that?
I think they set out to do that. As I say, they should have been in school, but obviously they were playing truants and they probably were bunking off school a few weeks before that. When they tried to abduct a little girl, they tried to entice her out of a school. So, you know, they definitely were out to take a child. If it hadn't been James, it would have been someone else's child. They would have definitely done it anyway.
So do you blame the truancy service and the school for not having spotted the behaviour that they were displaying?
Well, I think that, you know, the way it works today, all parents get a phone call if the child or kids aren't in school. And I'm just wondering why, you know, they let it slip that them two were missing on the same day. Whether they entered school in the beginning at 9 o'clock and then left the school early, I don't know. Or whether they just never went to school at all that day, I just really don't know. But the blame's got to lie with someone. The school, they should have been in the school, so the teachers then should have known, you know, where are they, and they should have informed the parents, why aren't your kids at school? But the parents should have also, they should have known if they were bunking off, because I know if any of my kids, if they don't attend school, I know.
Now, another major injustice comes into play. The understanding was that the killers could only keep their secret identities unless they re-offended. Well, as it turns out, John Venables did just that, many times. In 2008, he was taken into custody because he was sloppy drunk at a bar and got into a fight. He was given a warning by his probation officer. He was also just given a warning for having cocaine in his possession. During this time, Denise was dealing with some frightening things. She had a stalker. In 2008, a man called Denise's house, flooded her with messages, and sent a Christmas card decorated with hearts. After he was given a warning by the cops, this man sent her a lot of letters that had return addresses from various parts of the country. The battle came to a halt when the man sent a card from Portsmouth. Written inside, it said, "Ha ha ha, you can't catch me." The man, whose name is Howard Wilson, was found guilty of stalking Denise, as well as damaging a jail cell at Copy Lane Police Station in Liverpool. After sentencing, Denise was still afraid, even though Howard was in jail. She said, quote, "It feels like mental torture, even though he hasn't actually harmed me in any way. I'm convinced he's a ticking time bomb, but none of us knows when he's going to go off. It's terrifying, because the last time I used those words, it was over Thompson and Venables," end quote. In court, Howard wanted to give his reasoning for what he did, but he wasn't allowed to explain why he had stalked and harassed Denise, because honestly, there is no excuse for it. Allison Clarkson, the prosecutor, asked Howard, quote, "You can't accept that your obsession with Denise Fergus caused your distress, can you?" end quote. He kept sticking to his story that he didn't mean her any harm at all. In 2010, it was back to prison for John, as he was discovered to have images of sexual child abuse on his computer. He confessed that he had downloaded on his computer child pornography, as well as gave out these horrible things to other people. The images on his computer of these children were as young as 2. He also contacted a male pedophile named Leslie Blanchard from Chelmsford, and he gave him these pictures. The court heard that in emails to Leslie, John was pretending to be a 35-year-old married woman named Dawn who abused her 8-year-old daughter. John's aim was to get Leslie to send pictures of abuse to him, but instead, Leslie actually wanted to abuse, quote-unquote, Dawn's daughter himself. John, under the alias of Dawn, told the man that he could purchase total access to the girl. These were found in a lot of back-and-forth messages that they were sending via Google Hello. They both agreed on a price, and that Leslie could have the girl for a few hours. But John cut off Leslie completely, saying he couldn't see the girl. John was 27 years old at this time, and he told police that he was breaking the last taboo. He actually got caught because he gave his computer to the police, scared that his identity had been found out in February of 2010. The police looked through his computer and found everything. John attempted to delete a lot off of his computer and even went as far as trying to remove the hard drive with a can opener. Still, around 57 images were found. The defender of John said that he only did this because of the abnormal situation of having to live under a secret identity, and he was constantly in fear for his life. Continuing on to say that John being constantly alone made him go into a downward spiral of drinking and drugging. John Venables had also used quote-unquote peer-to-peer computer software to download videos of 8-year-old girls. Some were being raped by grown men. He confessed that he was turned on by all of this, and had even masturbated while watching the videos and looking at the pictures. He said he didn't have any intentions of having sex with a girl of that age. He was given a sentence of 2 years in jail. After his sentence, he was once again given a new secret identity. On Monday of 2016, it was late on August bank holiday. Denise said in court that one of her gates had been flung wide open that night. Her husband looked at their security camera footage and identified earlier recordings of Howard Wilson lurking nearby, then riding his bike towards their house. After Howard slung the gate open, he pedaled away briskly to the Quarry Green Social Club, where he would ask several people weird questions about Denise. 2 women at the social club were so concerned by Howard's conduct that they called Denise to let her know what was going on. As Howard was walking out of the social club, Denise was walking in. She said, quote, "I realized I'd seen him before. It was the fellow that stalked me 8 years ago. I said to him, 'Why can't you leave me alone? What do you want from me? Why are you harassing me?' He had his head down and carried on walking. I felt really anxious, and I knew I was in for a long night of no sleep." End quote. When giving her victim impact statement, she said, quote, "The fact that I do not know his intentions worries me. Why would someone attend my home address in the dark to sit and watch from the other side of the road? I felt the same way on this occasion as I did back in 2008 when Howard kept leaving things outside my address and knocking on my door wanting to speak to me. I am still on edge now. If I see a car or a person walking past that I don't know, my mind starts racing as to what could be going on. What worries me the most is that I believe Howard to be unpredictable. What could he do next? I am constantly thinking about the ifs and buts, as I do not know what he is capable of or what he may decide to do next to me or my family. I understand that he has to be released at some point. I am concerned he will come back and start terrorizing me. Or if he can't get at me, will he start terrorizing my lads? I really feel he should be tagged so his movements can be monitored and the safety of my family can be ensured. I just wish he would leave me alone so I can get on with my life. I have had enough to worry about and just want to enjoy my family life. End quote. Howard was sentenced to 26 weeks, and I haven't been able to find anything to imply that he has stalked or harassed her since. If I am wrong about that, please someone let me know and I'll clear it up in the beginning of the next episode. In 2017, John Venables was arrested yet again for 1,160 pictures of child abuse and videos that were discovered on his laptop, with almost 400 that were considered to be in the category of depraved. For this, he was sentenced to only 3 years and 4 months in prison. In 2018, reports came out that John could get taxpayer-funded plastic surgery to further protect his anonymity. Mr. Bulger wrote to the probation and parole boards before the hearing, demanding to know if Venables has received plastic surgery. Ralph spoke to the Mirror, saying, quote, "Taxpayers' money should not be spent giving a monster protection with a new face. There are plenty of great causes to spend public money on. Changing Venables' face is not one of them." End quote. Ralph, backed by James's Uncle Jimmy, did fight to get the anonymity order that protects John lifted, because John is a repeat offender. However, they wouldn't do it. Ralph has also been told that John is furious that he had to be in jail when he thought he was going to be released in time for Christmas. Ralph said, quote, "My child never saw a Christmas beyond his second birthday, and I hope Venables rots in his cell for the rest of his days." End quote. In March of 2020, it was reported that James's mom, Denise, spoke about what marked his 30th birthday. Quote, "It will mark what would have been James's birthday, and it's a big one coming up in March. He would have been 30, so that's going to be a special one for us. I think celebration is the wrong word. I've always said mark. I'll be marking what would have been James's birthday. It's a lovely night. Everyone with smiles on their faces. You wouldn't think that the person that it is for is not in that room. Because he is in that room. Even if it's just a picture, he is still in that room." End quote. September of 2020, John Venables was denied parole. James's mother, Denise, and now husband, Stuart, say they can rest easy knowing he is still in prison. John Venables would generally be released after 20 months, but he has a life license. That means he has to confront the parole board before he is released, and he is on parole until he dies. James's dad, Ralph, was happy with the decision and told the Mirror, quote, "This is the first time ever that the right decision has been made regarding my son's killers. I am so relieved because I was convinced he was getting out, just as he has done before. He may not stay in jail forever, but just knowing he is behind bars means children are safe from him for at least another 2 years." End quote. Robert Thompson hasn't caused any problems since his 2001 release, and has been in a relationship with another man and has shown remorse for his actions. Some of the things he has said are oddly worded, but at least he doesn't seem to be a threat to society. Also, there are huge issues that need to be addressed. This was and is a complete and utter injustice. The fact that John has been given 2 secret identities continues to show interest in not only children, which is horrible enough, but abused children. He's depraved. With everything he has done after the murder of James, he was able to remain anonymous. It's not fair to James, his family, or the public safety of others. For now, yes, he is in prison, as we know. But what will happen in the years to come? If he gets out, will he have another new identity? And if there's even a chance of that, we need to look into ways to change it. As a lot of us see this from the outside looking in, it definitely feels like laws care more about the life of a murderer who remained a pedophile more than the lives of children around him. Which, to me, just isn't right. Something needs to be done about it. I do have some things that I want to say that are personal experiences and feelings. If you don't want to hear that, please skip ahead a few minutes. I think a huge takeaway from this story for me personally, as I'm sure we all have personal takeaways from this, is that I have a 4-year-old cousin who is autistic, and his brother is almost 10. This case has made me even more cautious and aware of what's happening around them. It isn't just adults capable of these horrific things that I often tell you all about. It can be children, and I think that's even more terrifying in a way. We want to think that all children know better and wouldn't dare do something like this. We have to face the fact that it can happen, and it does happen. We have to emotionally and mentally soak that in. When we hear stories such as this tragic one, I think we can all take things away from these cases and learn something. Even if it's just one part of the story that turns that little light bulb on in your mind and you think, I never thought about that. There's always something to learn from these sad occurrences. Like I said, my 4-year-old cousin has autism. And he can communicate a little, but it's not always the best. The thought of someone taking advantage of that has made me cry myself to sleep. Especially thinking another child could take that split few seconds that a parent is distracted to lure them away and do something evil. To take advantage of a child's innocence is one of the most horrible things that I feel like could happen in this world. And it happens more often than I usually write about. For so many reasons, it's much harder to talk about children and babies that have had pure malevolence done to them. I recognize that their stories need to be told more because this is a major issue and needs to be addressed more often than it is. It affects all of us. You cannot think that this could never be you or someone you love. It absolutely can, and I will definitely start doing more cases, much like this one, and telling those stories throughout the future. I know some people can't handle hearing it, because it is so tough to listen to, but it's also about educating people. How can we make this world a safer place for the children in our lives? It opens up the conversation for that. I don't think every single one of us talks to our children about the dangers of being online enough, or as soon as they're old enough to understand, we need to talk to them about why they shouldn't stray away from their parents or whoever is taking care of them at the time. These are sometimes hard talks to have with children and toddlers. I will include links in the show notes of websites that are there to help us navigate these difficult conversations. Also, my 4-year-old cousin's brother will be turning 10 soon. I look at him and I think to myself, he doesn't have a mean bone in his body. Even if he did have a problem with anger or signs of withdrawing socially or anything that isn't like a child's typical behavior maybe should be, that's something that would most certainly be addressed and taken care of, even if that means getting professionals involved. At the end of the day, we can't predict what any child or grown adult will do, and I totally get that. However, we can do all we can to steer them down the right path. I think there's such a stigma about therapy in general for adults that we think children don't need therapy too. I look back and think, you know, wow, I could have actually gained a lot from therapy around that age because of the bullying I went through at school. Talking to my parents about it helped a little, but not a lot. I went through a lot of it on my own. Maybe all kids should have a counselor or therapist to talk to. Maybe we need to have that discussion within our families. My cousin, that's almost 10, is such a positive light in this world, even though he's not in a picture-perfect home at all, and he sometimes struggles with that, which a lot of children in this world do, and they don't do awful things like John and Robert. Thankfully, he and I can have these open conversations about anything that he's going through. He's so smart, not only academically, but he totally understands the conversations we have. I always let him know that no matter what, he can come and talk to me without judgment and without him having to be nervous or scared. I make sure that he knows that I am his safe place if he ever needs anything. If the news is on and he hears about crimes that have taken place, he'll ask, "How could anyone do that?" Or, "What? Why would someone do that?" It bewilders him. He is the same age as the two of those boys were, and he has the same reaction as we all do about crimes and murder that he overhears if the news is on. It makes me wonder, how can not one, but 2 10-year-olds do this? I can't wrap my mind around it. To this day, we don't know a motive. Me and my mother, we were talking about this, and she had so many questions, and I couldn't answer any of them. Hearing 10-year-old John and Robert's interrogations were scary and sad at the same time. Anytime I felt that sadness, I had to remind myself, these 10-year-olds premeditated this. They had allegedly planned this for a long time. I can't comprehend that. Denise has said that she didn't want them to spend their whole lives in prison for it, but had they spent time in an adult jail instead of feeling like they basically only got a slap on the wrist, it would have felt like some kind of justice, which I do agree with. I think the parents of James might agree that when John Venables went on to show the behavior that he did and repeated it multiple times, that luxury of having a private identity should have been stripped away from him. He's a total deviant who should not be roaming about in public. He shouldn't have access to computers or any way to communicate with children. All of this that he was able to have after he got in trouble the first time for child porn shouldn't have been allowed. That in itself is not justice. It only served him in a positive way, not anyone else around him, that's for sure. The fact that sometimes the law seems to cater more to pedophiles rather than cater to and care about the safety of our children is a failure of the justice system in my eyes. I see this going around in my own state. Something has to change. I understand that his identity was concealed because of the murder when he was 10. But now he has repeatedly done disgusting things that shouldn't allow him to keep that identity hidden any longer if and when he is free again. It's so important to note that when John Venables was out in public, people went to prison and some were sued for showing pictures of him in public and releasing his new name. Even an actress, Christina Milone, was given an 8-month suspended prison sentence for posting John's identity on Facebook. So if he does get out, I'd suggest, as badly as you may want to, not to do anything like that to get yourself in trouble if the system fails us and he gets another new identity. My heart goes out to the Bulger and Fergus families for their loss. To leave this on a much happier note, however, Denise announced on Twitter back in May of this year that she was becoming a grandmother. Miss Denise posted a picture of a little baby onesie that said, "Coming soon, baby Fergus, due in 2020, with two baby footprints with hearts on the bottom of the feet. There was also a picture of the ultrasound beside it. The picture was so precious. She and her husband Stuart congratulated her 26-year-old son Mickey and his partner Leanne McPadden as they relished in the good news. I am so happy for the families and send my congratulations to all of them." I also want to play a clip of Denise talking to Bay TV Liverpool about the James Bulger Memorial Trust.
By the time it was coming up to what should have been James's 18th birthday, you started thinking that it was time to remember him in a tangible way with some kind of charitable work, and after a false start with one charity, you decided to set up the James Bulger Memorial Trust. Tell us about that charity, what it does and why you're so keen on it.
Well, because it didn't work out with the other charity I was involved in. You know, I promised people a James Bulger house and I thought that's what, you know, I'm going to give people because I like keeping to my promises. As he says, as with talks with my family, Stuart and the boys, you know, would they still be willing to help me along with it? And they all agreed, and we decided that we'd go ahead and get a James Bulger house up and running.
And the story of how that happened is quite fascinating. We're here at James Bulger House now. Tell us what the charity does, first of all.
Well, we give free holidays to deserving kids who are going through severe bullying, kids who are doing well in society, doing well in school. We're just open to a wide range, really. Kids who have to care for parents or siblings. No, it's just a number of things that we give free holidays to. And it's a lovely place and a lovely area for the kids to be in.
And the way that you came by this caravan was quite fascinating. I believe it was donated by Well-Wisher originally, and you've done a lot of work on it since then. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we have done a lot of work on it. This caravan was donated by a lovely lady. Sadly, she bought this house and this caravan with her husband, but her husband passed on. She seen, when we'd done a race for James, she seen it on Gnosis Reports, and she decided that she wanted to donate the caravan to us, and that's how it all come about. It was a bit of a sad story that she lost her husband, and you know, it was hard to take this caravan off her, but she insisted on us having it.
And you've done a lot of work on it to refurbish it, and I believe the curtains that we see around here have been made by your own fair hands. Tell us about that.
Never again. Never do it again. We tried to save some money. Obviously, curtains aren't cheap these days, and I said to Stuart, instead of going out buying them, because there's all different size windows anyway, it would have been a bit awkward to get the sizes, so I went and bought a load of material and sat on this floor and cut them all up and stitched them on that table over there.
And they look very good now.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. As always, stay safe and hug the kids in your life. Tell them how much you love them. Until next time, I love you guys.